Hello and welcome to the new episode of the Road Trip Playlist Podcast. I'm super excited about this week's episode. I say that about every episode, but this one's a really fun one. My guest is Sammy Ray from Sammy Ray and the Friends. If you're a new listener and don't know this about me, my name is Thomas Darrow. I am the host. I've been writing about music for, now it's crazy and sad to say because I feel old, but I've been writing for 4 years now. And so I started writing when I moved to New York in 2018. And then close to the pandemic or a little bit before, I moved back to Utah. And during the pandemic, it was one of those times when I just really missed New York. I missed living in Brooklyn. I missed everything about it. And so I was up like way later than anyone should be. It was like 2 a.m. and I was scrolling Spotify and just trying to find new music. And I found Sammy Ray and the Friends, and it instantly brought me back. It felt like Brooklyn. I didn't know that this was a band from Brooklyn. I had never heard of Sammy Ray and the Friends before. And so when I go and I look at the bio section of Spotify and find out, oh no, this is a Brooklyn-based band, and it just felt so familiar, and it was so fun, and it was very happy and a very, very good memory, and I fell in love with their music. I love this band so much. And so I'm so excited to talk with Sammy Ray, who leads this band, and it's this incredible band. It's a big band. It's an 8-piece band. It has a rhythm section, a horn section, background singers, dancers. It's this collective that calls themselves the Friends, and it very much feels that way. And when you listen to the music, you feel like a friend. And I'm excited to share this. I'm excited to share them. And I love the conversation that I had with Sammy Ray. We talk about how the Friends came together, how it became this band. And we talk about how the band grew from playing for tips in New York City to ultimately now this week they have a show coming up at Terminal 5 in New York when we discover it's a Sour Patch show. You'll get that joke as you listen. That's the very end of the episode. We talk about the early days of Sammy Ray performing music in Brooklyn libraries for kids and au pairs and how that ended up meeting the bandmates and turning into Sammy Ray and the Friends off of inspiration from Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band and so much more. I really enjoyed the conversation with Sammy Ray. I hope you enjoy it too. And so that's enough for me. I hope that you enjoy the episode. I hope you enjoy listening. I hope you enjoy the band's music as you listen and see them when you can. I'm very excited to see the band live for the first time this week in New York City, and I couldn't recommend seeing them live more. So here it is. Let's go on a road trip.
Starting route to the Road Trip Playlists podcast with Sammy Ray and the Friends. Estimated time of arrival 62 minutes. Enjoy.
Hello, hello. How are you?
Hello, hello. Hi. My apologies for my lateness.
Are you kidding? No, I would wait all day. It's been quite a back and forth, and I've been so glad because we were coordinating while you were on tour, and I'm like, I can't imagine doing this like on a tour bus. How crazy your schedule must be. So it's great to be with you. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. I'm going to grab my charger. It's so good to finally connect with you. Thank you for being so back and forth with me.
No, I'm very grateful. I have to tell you, I like telling people how I first found them and what made me even like put out a request to do an interview. I lived in New York. I moved to New York from 2018 to 2019. And it was one of the best times of my life. It's how I started doing music writing. I never thought that I would. And I never knew like really anything about it. And so it gave me this incredible opportunity to do music writing. But then I ended up getting a job opportunity in Utah, where I'm from, that brought me back to Utah. And while I was there, kind of depressed about my decision about moving back to Utah, and I had lived there for like a year and a half, and I was like, oh, I just want to be back in New York. I found Sammy Ray and the Friends. And so I was listening, it was probably like 2:30 a.m. when you shouldn't be scrolling Spotify, but I was just looking for new music. And so I found the band and I was like, this feels like Brooklyn where I lived. And I was like, oh my gosh, I want to be back. And then I look and of course it's a Brooklyn band. And yeah, it was amazing. And so it brought me back. And it was ultimately like around the time when it was like, okay, I need to get back to New York. So now I'm here, I'm back. But so then this
the band was something that brought me so much joy because it was like what I was missing. And it made me feel a little bit back of that, that time of my life that was like really happy and really changed my life. And so then, yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is a pleasure to be here with you. And like I said, I would have waited as long as it took.
Ah, those are such kind words. Nobody's ever told me before that we sound like Brooklyn, which is, I think, the biggest affirmation I've ever heard. So thank you very much. Then we did the thing, right?
You did the thing. And so, yeah, it was absolutely, you do sound like Brooklyn. And it was like, I knew right away there was something about it. I don't know what it was, but it just brought me back. So yeah, I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be able to come to the show this month. I can't imagine what, I just have heard amazing things about the live shows. Can you tell me a little bit about the special experience that is a Sammy Rae and the Friends live show?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, going off what you said about being such a Brooklyn sound, I think we are, I would hope, a testament to what it's like to be a rock band from New York, right? Because when you see our live show, it's very clear that we are seven people who come from very different studies of music, right? So one of my sax players is a like straight ahead jazz guy, and one of them is a pop sensibility guy, and my bassist and my drummer kind of come from world music, and my guitarist is a rock and roll guy, and I'm a folk rock, classic rock kind of guy, and my keys player is just all over the place, and she's been on Broadway a bunch. So we have a lot of different influences coming together in one place, and that's what's special. This is a selling point that is difficult for my team to like put into words when they're trying to sell us, but like the cohesivity, like the cohesive Friends thing is that there's no cohesivity, right? Somehow it always sounds like a Friends song because there's so much going on, but I think that adds a really special element to our live show. And from the very beginning, when I started a band, I am the front person, but I never wanted to be a solo artist. So what's unique about this is everybody's taking solos. Everybody has a moment in the spotlight. And what I hope, and I've been told is so clear from watching our show, is that we really just are seven people who are like best friends and we care about each other so much. So my hope is when somebody comes to a live show that that's really tangible, right? These people really care about each other and they really care about themselves and believe in themselves. And it hopefully gives the audience permission to do those same things. And we always try to, you know, with every single note that we play, express our gratitude. That's a big thing for us is, we all spent so many years doing the thing where you don't really get paid or you get tips. So now that we have this, you know, beautiful thing going on where we're actually making money to travel around the world and live our dreams, like we understand that it's only because of the generosity and support of the audience. So our big thing is expressing that gratitude and trying to show how thankful we are and encouraging everybody in the audience to be friends with each other.
Absolutely. And I love that because like when I started writing about shows, I realized the ones that were most special to me were the ones where you could go and you feel and like after you leave, it's like, maybe I'm not going to talk to anyone in this room, but I knew that if I did after this show that like I could make friends with anyone that's here. And so the first show I ever reviewed had that feeling. And it was like this thing of, it's one of the highest praise. And that's what when I read about a Sammy Rae and the Friends show, that's what I like. It's overwhelming the amount of people that say things like that. And so I can't wait to be there. I want to be a friend. And so
you are a friend. Literally, if you are in the music and you are supporting us in the way that you're supporting me right now, you're a friend. That's the whole thing. That's the Friends. Big Friends energy.
Big Friends energy. I love that. Now I wanted to ask how the tour's been. When I prepared this interview, it was the day before that you were like heading out on tour. And I was excited to ask you about what it's been like having a tour bus for the first time. What's been the tour? What's been highlights of the tour? How's having a bus been?
The bus was amazing. It took all of the things about a long form tour that make it stressful and kind of made them go away. I mean, it does have its own quirks, right? Like you're sleeping in a little bunk and you're going over your bumps and all that. And it has its quirks. But what was really special about it was, you know, when we were driving in a van, my big thing was like, we only ever had 6 hours max at the hotel because you have to drive from one city to the next city. It's like you have to drive an hour after the gig when you're tired to crash at that hotel, but then you have to be up and in the van at 7 a.m. driving straight to soundcheck, and then you get out and it's soundcheck. So, you know, it was hard to get enough sleep. It was hard to feel like we actually got a chance to visit the cities that we were so lucky to be traveling to. So on the bus, it's great because number one, none of us has to, you know, really, sleep well and eat well and make sure that we're really rested because none of us had to drive. So we had a driver. So that was great. And we could all focus on being in a band. But additionally, you know, we would go to sleep and then wake up in the next city and had this whole day to see St. Louis and Amazing. Atlanta and all these places that we've never seen before. So it definitely was, it was a really special experience to be able to see so much of the country and not just drive through it. And it was, you know, it was really comfortable. It was like, I'm not living out of a bag that I'm going to a different hotel every night. It's like, I have my little, it's little, but all my things are there in my little bunk and I can come out of my green room and be in my bunk and it's fine. Of course, on tour, there's always these things like we have to learn how to live simply and learn how to have very few things. And it was nice to also have so much time together. It wasn't everybody catch and sleep when they can. It's like we were all well rested and we could all have coffee in the morning and it was great. It was just wonderful. And the rooms were a lot bigger than usual this time around. Like we did something like 25 dates and you know, we're used to playing big rooms like 1500 cap in New York. But to go and do that all over the country was just really humbling and really encouraging. It was like, you know, I know we can sell all these tickets in New York, but I don't know if anybody cares about us in Seattle. And then we go sell out a room that size in Seattle. And it's like, my God, they like us out here too. So very, very encouraging, very, very, very exciting. And, you know, I'm sure that when we have shorter runs, we'll go back to sprinter life, but the bus was a glow up for sure.
That's amazing. What's it like with the bandmates? Is it nice being that close? Is there, I had a joke. I wanted to ask if there's band pillow talk at night, like when you're all in bunks.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's so bizarre. We have this thing. I don't know. At this point we've been doing this for 4 years and we have always used language like sustainability and longevity and family. And, we always think about each other like siblings, right? Which is how it feels. But in that, while it's like, you know, we might be doing this for 20 years, y'all, like we're stuck with each other. We might be doing this for 30 years, longevity, sustainability. It's incredibly important that we communicate. It's incredibly important that our relationships maintain strong. But in that siblingship, we also give each other permission to like butt heads a little bit, you know, but there's never big blowouts, but it's just like, you know, when you did that, I didn't really like it. Okay. Well, when you did that, I didn't really like it. And then one of us is always like, guys, rhythm section, calm down. Like, let's talk about our emotions. So it was, and being on top of each other for so long, obviously what we were doing for the first time, it's like a little house. So what we had never done together in all these 4 years was like, have the same house. I like it clean. Well, I don't want to wash dishes after the show. Well, you know, so the learning how to live together was definitely a hurdle that took a couple of days, but yeah, we're close and we care so deeply about each other. There's no real drama, you know? And I think it's kind of a chicken before the egg thing because we had all been in projects with folks that we didn't really jive with. So in figuring out who this touring band was going to be, you know, a couple of years ago, I was really focusing on making sure relationships were strong and that we all were similar people with similar interests and of course we differ in different ways. But, you play a really big show. And I think what we all went to piggyback off your pillow talk thing, I think what we all went through this month that was new for all of us was this sense of like, I hate the word like fame with a lowercase f, but that really is how it felt. Like there was a security situation every night where like people would be outside the bus and we need to get on with a security guard. And we were all kind of processing at the same time in different ways what it's like to be in a room full of 1500 people where everybody in the room wants to talk to you really bad. So, you know, that figuring out what it was like to, you know, we're not just Brooklyn legends, LOL. It's like when we go to Seattle, there's 1500 people that want to be near us. And it was kind of this shared struggle and also this shared joy of processing what it was like to be so visible with each other, right? There's other bands that understand this, but like the only real people who understand this struggle and also this joy I'm going through are the six people that are with me in this band. So that was a huge bonding thing for all of us. Y'all, we're really out here right now. So it was great. We came back much closer. And of course we all play, some of us play in different projects and some of us have partners. And so we got off the bus and went and did our own things, but we always come back and we're getting ready for the show at T5 on the 30th. So that's something that we're all looking forward to as well.
Well, I loved your post because you talked about, you really illustrated the journey of the band where it's, you went from playing for tips, like you've gone from playing for tips in New York City to playing Terminal 5, which is incredible. And I wondered also, like, if there was ever any, like at the beginning stages, I imagine with a larger band, it's probably like when you think like, I don't know. I just imagine financing and things. I don't have a music background. I fell into this accidentally, but I just imagine when you think of things like financially, when it comes to like going on the road or touring. And my main question is like, what's the journey been like so far? And was there ever any pushback of bringing such a like big group together? But then now when you've done it, how cool is that?
It is really cool. Again, it's like hard to, because I think we had a climb that was so atypically fast. We had this huge uptick during the big lockdown months of 2020, where we had this EP that we were going to tour for 6 weeks and then everything got canceled. Yeah. We ultimately decided to release the EP after all, and we kind of transferred this, how do we capture this deep sense of community, which is so tangible at our shows, to the online space. And it worked. We were having different live streams 3 nights a week. It was, you know, me and Seabass talking about this, me and James talking about that, me and Will talking about this, me and another band leader talking about this. And we were really transparent about all the struggles we were going through of not being able to tour and how much we missed it in the digital space, especially on Instagram. And the sense of community just got so strong, because I think in that moment, everybody was really longing for a sense of community because we couldn't see anybody. Like, we were all stuck in our houses. So when that EP came out and we were doing so much to stay connected with our audience online, we had this huge kind of uptick, which nobody expected. So there was really this, like, we were playing New York and like maybe Boston, Philly, DC. And then there was a year and a half of lockdown where nobody could play. We dropped the CP, this crazy thing happened. And then by the time we could play again, we really skipped a lot of these milestones where we were going in, you know, in maybe DC from selling 150 tickets to selling 1,000 tickets. So it was really this like smack in the face where suddenly it was like, we have to go on tour again. We have to do it on a bus and we have to do it in 1500 caps. So it was really jarring. But again, so I think that we're all a little late to catching up with the gratitude. And I often say like, how do I hold all this? Right. But it's wonderful. It's overwhelmingly good. And the thing that you said about so many people in a project and how cool that is, that was something that held us back a little bit in the beginning, because I hate to label myself, but like, here I am like this female queer band leader. And I'm like, I have a million people in my band. You're going to trust us. You're going to fly us all out. You're going to put us all up and it's going to be great. Because of that, so many people, such a big vision. We could only play a couple of cities. We couldn't drive really far. But, you know, I refuse to pare down, and we have 7 people and we're all killing, and we're coming with a sound guy and we're coming with a costume lady, and you're going to put us all up. And every time, especially a Northeast city like Philly or Boston or DC, where we've played 3 or 4 times, every time we come back, we sell out the next size room, and it's always, you know, we impress them. So, it's been great that these venues trust me and trust us to come out. And I think it's not something you see very often is such a big band. And something you see even less often is a big band where it's always the same players.
Yeah.
Right. My vision was the E Street Band, where, you know, here's Stevie Van Zandt and he's as killing as Bruce, who is as killing as Clarence Clemens, who is as killing as, you know, Patti Sciolfa. And it's always the same people. You can look and any one of them is as connected and as talented as the one next to them. That was always my vision. So I think that's very rare. And I'm glad that we've been able to preserve that. I think it puts us in this, we occasionally get this like, oh, they're like a band stuck in the past. Like it's like a real classic rock band thing with this more modern sound. And that's what I always wanted. So, yeah, we're grateful for that. There's a lot of us, there's a lot to keep track of. I think I'm like a mother before my time sometimes, or sometimes like, you know, we brought on somebody to help with merch for this bus run. And she had never been out on the road with us before. We'd worked with her in the city, but then she came out and she's like, oh my God, it's like herding cats. They're everywhere. But it's great. It's good. It's big. I would rather get lost in a big family and share that spotlight with six other people than be a front person of a quartet where all eyes are on me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's where you articulated. I appreciate it, because I asked you like this sloppy question that I hadn't really, like, it came to me as I was asking, and it was like, I was asking you three questions in one. So I appreciate you articulating that so well, because what I was noticing
in my
prep, I was like, it shows a lot of you as like a band leader to really, like, you've always championed like each member of the band. You talked about each person having space for a solo, like those things are special. And that's what I was wanting to highlight, was because I imagine along the road, there was probably meetings or different things where it was like, can we do three people? Can we do four people? Can we do like less? And then, but it shows to you as always, like kind of putting the band as a whole big. And I knew that some of the influences from my research with the E Street Band. And so I loved that and wanted to like note that in what I said, in that question. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
But I wondered too, where you mentioned about each member having time in a show for a solo to show kind of some of the musical, like study show their own like art with their solos. I wondered how much the live element lends to your songwriting. Is it's one where it's like you listen, the first thing I listened to is I just wish I could like be at Brooklyn Bowl listening to this band when I was listening in my room at 2:30 in Utah. And I was like, I just want to see this band like play like a Brooklyn Bowl show. I can't imagine how good they are live. Like listening right now, I'm loving this, but I can't imagine what the sound is live. Like it's just it would just be a party. And so how much of like the live element goes into the songwriting together?
It's a really interesting question. I think now, right, in the most recent full-length EP we put out, which was Let's Throw a Party, and even then that was a year ago, and the singles that we've released since and the singles that we're working on now, there's much more of this live sensibility that goes into the writing, where it's like, okay, let's do an 8-bar horn solo here, but let's make it longer. And so let's, on the record, make sure that it leaves room to be made longer live. And, you know, we are able to do these things live that we never thought about to do in the studio before. If we can do it, we may as well do it in the studio. And I kind of despair sometimes, because when I think about The Good Life, which is, you know, the EP that made us pop off, if you will, songs like Kick It to Me and The Feeling, they're amazing, but I wrote them when I was 20 and I recorded them when I was 21, when I had absolutely no live experience and I was just making a record like in a studio. I didn't know what it would be like to try to translate that live. And so I'm like singing really hard, but it's not really sustainable to do 30 nights a week. Or I picked a kind of difficult key that is hard to do 30 nights a month or 25 nights a month or whatever. I've connected with some other front people and lead singers on this as well, where I'm like, how do I, you know, when I wrote this stuff when I was younger, I didn't know I was going to have to perform it in front of 2,000 people. You try to dream big, but like, because I didn't have the muscle memory and like the reps of playing live shows, I didn't know how do I figure out how to be in love with those songs again and not, you know, dread them coming up in the set list. And it you know, everybody's kind of shared with me the same thing, that was like, it starts with the writing process. So now as you're writing, you need to write and record things that you are going to be excited to play live and that you can play live every single night. And when it comes to the older material, you know, what happens on the record is a timestamp of where that song was when it was recorded at the very early stages of its life. You know, it's foolish to think that we're going to record the feeling and then we're going to play it for 150 shows, 150 times, and it's not going to adjust, right? We've come up with this fill, and then it's, oh my God, that fill was killing. And then we talk about it after the show. When you did that thing, let's do it again tomorrow, right? And so the songs will evolve once they're off the record. So in my opinion, they get more cool because we've been living with this song for a week. Now it's time to go to the studio. We've lived with it for years. So, and I think, you know what the feeling sounds like on the record, and you know what Kick It To Me sounds like on the record. When you come to the live show, you probably want to see something and hear something a little bit different because you've listened to that song a million times. So we give ourselves permission when it comes to the old material to adjust and evolve the songs live. And in the writing process now with new stuff, we're a little more attentive to, you know, this thing is allowed to change, but we're going to live with it forever. It's our baby. Let's make sure it's good before we give it to the world. So definitely touring has affected the way that we write and record. And our live show is, you know, we're doing very different versions of the songs, but we're not losing the heart of the song and the heart of why people fell in love with it in the first place.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I love, it's interesting. It's so interesting to hear the other side and how changing it, like how the thinking of things like, oh, singing this every night or singing in this key live is like, it might strain it. Like those parts that me as a musical person would not think of. And so it's interesting. And I also wanted to ask as well with the songwriting, as you as the main songwriter of the band, what it's been like to, like, I guess the process of getting to know kind of each member of the band and the unique like sound and like skills that they bring, and so that you can really get the best. What's been like, how have you been able to ensure, like, because you do such a great job of really, like I said, championing every individual as an artist, but how do you like ensure that you are getting the best out of each person in their skill set?
That's a great question. That starts in the writing too, right? Because when we made The Good Life, I was still trying to find players. And now that we have all the time players, I was like, let me write a horn line. But now I'm thinking, you know, let me write a horn line that Kellen Reese can play better than anybody in the world. Or let me write a horn line that Max Zoy can play better than anybody else in the world. Because I know they're going to be on the record. I know they're going to be out live with us. It's my all the time guy. So as we learn each other's skill sets and like wheelhouses, it informs the writing. So it's not just, hey, I wrote this thing, play it. It's, I wrote this thing for you. You play it how you're going to play it better than anybody. And it's nice because some songs will call for big jazz energy. And I know that those two are going to solo. And sometimes it calls for more pop stuff. And I'll say, those two are going to solo. And in the writing process, let me go, you know, hey, I'm trying to do this pop thing. Let me go to them for feedback. Right. So I'm always sourcing inspiration and input from them in the writing process. And it's also this element of like, you know, quite literally, like we're in the set list. And well, Debbie hasn't taken a solo in five songs. This is where we put the key solo, right? Let's write in the key solo. It's knowing each other so well now both informs the way that I'm writing and the way that we're playing, right? If we're in some crazy jazz key and there's all these weird changes, like you are more apt to solo over that than you are. So you take it instead of you, but the next time you're going to take that one.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, that makes total sense.
Make any sense?
No. I loved hearing, we've talked a lot about the band, but I was fascinated as well in like interviews that I listened to you talking about kind of you coming up on your own. And I laughed when I was hearing you making it as like a, you were touring like libraries and schools to play children's music. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, of course. Well, it's an interesting story. I went to college for 1 year to study sound engineering and audio technology because, number one, sound engineer sounded more official to my parents than I wanted to be in a rock band. So I was like, I'll go be a sound guy. And I was studying that for a year, and I very quickly realized that that was not I wanted to be on the other side of the booth, right? I wanted to be a performer. Yeah. But I mean, I'm from a small town in Connecticut, and nobody really in my family is musical like that. So I had no positive example or role models of people who actually try to make music. And like, you just hear this thing all the time, the stereotype of like, yeah, I tried the city for 10 years and it turned me hard and I didn't make any music and I quit. Right. So when I was realizing that this sound engineering thing, which sounded like a, you know, to be an audio engineer was a more structured thing, when that wasn't working out for me, and I knew I wanted to be an artist, but I still had this pressure to attend college, I was like, well, I guess I can't go to school for music. I guess that I'm not supposed to do this thing. And my other deep love always in my life has been kids and kids entertainment. And I'm in love with not necessarily academia, but like pedagogy and the study of, you know, what's happening in those first couple of years, how kids' brains are forming. And I loved kids' media and kids' books and kids' music. And I mean, not the baby stuff, not nursery rhymes, but there are some really powerful artists out there who make really wonderful music that doesn't underestimate kids. And you look to like, you know, Mr. Rogers has always been a huge role model of mine because he never underestimated children and he never underestimated anybody. He was like, you know, everybody needs to process and understand death, and kids can handle it. So don't underestimate them. Let's make music and let's make a show that explains death or something like that. Divorce. Two kids. And I always really admired that. So I thought that my mission was to go be a teacher. So I left my sound engineering school and I enrolled at Manhattan College in the Bronx to study education. And I was going to get my ed degree. And after one semester, I was like, can't be done. And now also I'm in the epicenter of the industry I really want to be in. Like now I'm in New York City. I'm not in small town, woodsy Connecticut. So after that semester, I ultimately left college, much to the despair of my mom, who has since come around. But I was like, I gotta go try to be in a band. And she was like, what? So I left, and I had spent like 2 years like waitressing and nannying and like canvassing and like working for I was a medical clerk for a second, and I was miserable. But then I had this gig come through where somebody was like, here's the gig. You play keys for birth to three, 5 days a week for 45 minutes. The pay is really good. And I fell into this thing, which is essentially, it was like a preschool taught by a three-person band instead of a teacher. And we followed a curriculum. Wow. And it was so cool. So suddenly I was in front of kids again, making a difference. I was playing my instrument every single day and getting more killing as a musician in general. And I was meeting all these other wonderful musicians. And not for nothing, but if you are a killing musician who can wake up after the gig to play an 8 a.m. Saturday class for three-year-olds, you're a pretty good person, right? So I formed, you like, you're not an idiot. So I formed some really great connections that way. And that's kind of how I got into playing with other people. Because you're playing this class, and actually my drummer, Seabass, who is my dear kindred soul and a huge part of my musical story. I met him playing kids music, and we're just playing. And then there was one day where he was just like, hey, when we do whatever today, it was like, I've been working on the railroad or whatever. He's like, when we play that today, think about it in five. And I was like, all right, whatever. And then after a couple of classes, I was like, you're really killing. Like, do you want to mix? I have original stuff. Do you want to play it with me? And he was like, sure. And then wow. We started rehearsing, and then I added other people, and suddenly we were the friends and we were playing gigs, and we had to quit our kids' day job to go on tour. Yes. And Will Lee, who is our guitarist, he and I Also, I mean, we met at an open mic, we met like on the scene, but we connected because he was also working for a kids program and I was working for a kids program. And he was like, you know, I got this look where I have to go play this kids gig at the Brooklyn Public Library. It's state funded. It pays so much money. Do you want to be on this with me? And I was like, sure. So then we formed a kids duo called Jam I Am. And then we, and what our goal was with our show, and we spent that whole summer touring the Brooklyn Public Libraries and getting asked back, and we were like making all this money. Our bag was that we didn't want to underestimate kids. So like, while kids do want to hear Row, Row, Row Your Boat, like they also want to hear like Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard and like Yellow Submarine. And in right. So the next thing we know is like, we're playing at the Brooklyn Public Library for like 500 kids and their caregivers. And we're trading solos on Cecilia or whatever, and the kids don't know what the song is about, but they're living their life and the nannies are having a great time too. So that's actually where we like kind of cut our teeth with, that's where I kind of cut my teeth with being in front of audiences.
Wow.
Was like, if you can hold it together and take a solo in front of a screaming 2-year-old and like make them feel better by the end of the song, it's really encouraging. And there is no less forgiving audience than a bunch of toddlers. So at the same time, while me and Will were doing the Jam I Am thing and we were playing for the libraries and me and Seabass were playing the kids shows in the morning, the Friends was this thing that was me and Will and Seabass and like a drummer, I'm sorry, a bassist and two horn players that we had met elsewhere from the other actual bands we were in. And I formed the Friends and we were like, going back to this, like playing for tips days, it was like when we first started playing around New York at like Rockwood and everything, it was like, we would go play Wednesday at 11 PM, which is not a desirable slot, but we would play it to get the reps and we would make like $40 in tips. But then me and Seabass had to go to sleep and wake up and be at the classroom at 9 AM. And eventually the Friends thing just kept bubbling and bubbling and we had to leave all the kids stuff behind and go be on tour. And that's where we are now. But it really did fill my cup a lot. Like I was meeting musicians all the time and I was like making kids happy and like making all these like au pairs and nannies happy. And that was really that time period where I was able to shed this thing of like, I'm not good enough to be a full-time musician, because I was playing these like low stakes gigs, but I was feeling really good. I was seeing the impact I was having it on an audience, even though they were like 2.5. And it's very similar. I've always tried to, in Friends material, I've always tried to make the songs and the live show accessible to everybody. And obviously, like, we're not, if you bring your 3-year-old to a 2000 cap room with a light show, like they're not going to have the best time. But I've always kept to that philosophy of like, I need to write a song such that everybody can access it. That's kind of been the line that I've always tried to toe as a songwriter. And when I used to give songwriting lessons for a while during COVID, and I would always give these examples of like a counter example is like Paul Simon. And we love Paul Simon. He's one of the most talented songwriters to ever live. He's a legend. But when Paul Simon writes songs sometimes, and I think of like Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes, the whole verses are exposition. It's like, she was wearing this colored dress and she was standing here next to the place where I drank my first cocktail, and like her ex-boyfriend I went to college was there. And it's like, yeah, that's great, Paul, but you can access that, right? There's so many details. You get it. It doesn't ring true for me. So I've always tried to walk this line where our songs are personal enough to me that I can really deliver, but also accessible enough to a general audience where anybody can come and enjoy this music. And a part of that has always been kids to me, right? There's no reason for me to use 4-syllable adjectives in a song when I can just as adequately get it across in another way. And, you know, what we've achieved in that is music that is accessible to the bulk of our audience, which is like young, creative, predominantly queer, but also their parents come and vibe. And we have 12-year-olds in front of us sometimes at like festivals. We see these like 11-year-olds in the front row that are freaking out. And also like mom and dad can come and enjoy it. So from using kind of that attitude of not taking yourself too seriously when making music that I have from the kids era, and also kind of those guidelines of how do I make music that everybody can access, that's really informed the music that we make now. Amazing. You know? Yeah. It was wild. I had so much fun. It was so great. And I was making really, really good money. So there was no reason not to do it. But on the kind of like darker side, not dark, but like there are also, you know, everybody in that network was, they had side projects. They were trying to get to pop off and they would wake up to make their money doing the kids stuff. And a lot of people just got comfortable and now they're like still doing that thing, making all that money. And they never got a chance to really throw down hard into their thing. So there's a lot of like people that are kind of jaded about it in there, but they're good people still.
Yeah.
So I count myself very lucky to have kind of pushed past that and now be in a full-time touring project. I mean, this is my full-time job, but I miss it. Sometimes I miss it. It filled my cup, man. Totally. It was really fun.
Oh my gosh. That's one of my favorite answers I've ever gotten on the podcast. It is so fun. Cause I also didn't know all the connections with the band. Like I knew that you did it and I was aware of that. And like when I was preparing, one of my friends is like one of your biggest fans. And so I was texting her about like the interview. I'm like, did you know she used to like play at libraries and play all these kids shows? And like, I was so excited finding out. I didn't know that that's where you met Seabass or Will. And that's so funny. And it's fun. And also hearing the joy from it. And so thank you. That's one of my favorites.
Oh, of course. Thank you so much. Yeah, it was a great low stakes environment for me to learn how to be in front of people and like lose the stage fright and they're three, so they're so forgiving. If you mess up, you jump back in, they don't even realize. But then when you think about it, like the rest of my audience now, 2,000 people in front of us, it's a very similar thing. Like there's no reason for me, oh my God, I messed up that one note, I have to worry about it for the rest of the set. It's like, move on, it's okay. Absolutely. You know, just keep playing. So I learned a lot from that time period, and it's still a huge, it's still something I care very deeply about, which is again why it so often influences my current writing. And I would love to find a way as I get older to really hone into. I would love to make a kid's record. Like artist that I, do you know the band Circus Survive, fronted by Anthony Green? Okay, so it's this band that was more popular when I was in college, and it's like really mathy, screamy punk metal kind of stuff, and this guy is like screaming way up at the top of his range, and it's that kind of stuff that you really angsty college kids loved. And then he grew up and got married and had some kids, and he has since made more than one kids album, and he's still singing way up there and going crazy. And then he makes his kids record, and then the next month he's in the studio with his other project and he's making Circus Survive material. But that's the kind of thing that I want to do, is like that his record is, while it is kids songs, it's like a song about your dog or whatever. Yeah. It's really killing. The chorus is in six. The changes are really cool. And it, you know, we don't need to underestimate kids. So I do have a dream of figuring out how to make media for kids as I get older and I can focus on it a little bit more.
That's amazing. Yeah. I want to stick to our time. I appreciate your time so much. I'm leaving a lot of questions on the table though, which is fine. I just hope we get a chance to talk again.
I have time, so please don't worry about it. I'm not doing anything really.
I wanted to ask one of my best friends that I told you about, that's your biggest fan, called you a queer icon. And I wanted to ask how that is, because you mentioned how like a big part of your fan base is queer. What's it like for you to be able to like be called that one, and also like make music that's loved by like that large group of people?
It's wild. It really is wild. So me being like in the middle of my teens and even younger, I mean, there's this thing I've been seeing going around with all of this like terrible legislation that's going around and trying to like limit trans rights and pull certain states who are trying to roll back on legalizing gay marriage, which is okay, whatever. But anyway, I've been seeing this thing going around a lot, which is like, your kids are going to end up queer, whether or not you talk to them about it. Right. Yeah. There's only so long you could push down who you really are. And I'm a huge, huge advocate of being your authentic self. It's the easiest and least work and most fun thing in the world is to be yourself. It's the best way to live your life. It takes too much energy and too much effort to spend your life trying to appease folks who that's not you, you know? Yeah. And when you make a decision to really be yourself and live for yourself, you attract the sort of people you want to attract. You attract the experiences you want to attract. And I remember when I was young, going back to this, your kids will always be queer thing. I was really obsessed with like Elton John and Freddie Mercury and like Mika, if you remember Mika,
yeah,
and like Joan Jett. And I didn't have language yet to be like, what is this thing that I love about them? Which I now understand is they're all queer icons who were just really feverishly themselves. And obviously Elton John and you know, we know what happened to Freddie, and that was terrible. Freddie didn't really come out of the closet until very close to his death. But I was obsessed with this like refusal to confine to gender constraints and like refusal to be married to the gender binary. I mean, you look at the music video for I Want to Break Free and all of Queen is in full drag. And there was never this moment of, oh, now that I know Freddie's gay, I hate Queen. It's like at that point they were already icons. It didn't need to be said. Right. And as I got older, I started to realize, again, this is why I was so obsessed with these artists, because they were so feverishly themselves. I want to be that. And then I started to, as I got older, understand that what they were doing to be themselves was to be unabashedly and like unafraid of being queer. And I understand in the 70s and the 80s, it was a much different bit to be vocal about that and not have it negatively affect your artistry. Mm-hmm. And for that, I'm very grateful that I'm here where I am now and that those queer icons have paved the way. But what I think about our show now, my queer friends and the queer people I see in my audience and myself, I think what most queer people are after is a sense of community where they don't feel othered. And it's not like, we're accepting you because you're a part of the LGBTQIA community. It's like, come as you are, right? That's what it is. Absolutely. And if you're an ally, if you're straight, if you're part of the LGBTQIA community, just come as you are. Let's not work to, it's like the rainbow washing thing in Pride, right? Where you get all these ads that are like, hi, gay, here's 10 rainbow dollars for you to use at Old Navy. It's like, just chill out, you know? So what I've always tried to do is, I try to be the queer artist that I really needed when I was in my teens, which is somebody who is unabashedly themselves and is willing to advocate for their community when it's really important, but that's not my sole identifier, right? Yeah. Because number one, that is maybe too much for a young queer person who's still navigating. And also it can be too much for your parents.
Yeah.
Like I had friends when we were young where it was like, oh, you literally can't listen to Queen because I don't want you to be influenced by whatever. And this is a very different thing, but it's the same thing as, you know, like in the 50s, they would only film Elvis from the top up because the parents didn't want his hips influencing the youth and driving them crazy or whatever. Right. So I want to, my mission is to make good music and put on an incredible live show and be a good person who it's not my first and sole identifier that I'm queer. So when you dig into it, you say, wow, what a wonderful environment where everybody is being themselves. They're giving each other permission to be themselves. They're very accepting. They're very loving. Everybody here is just looking for a good time and a sense of community and friendliness, right? And then when, if you dig a little deeper, you go, oh, the front person is queer. This is a queer fronted project. And I'm looking around and a lot of these folks what is it to identify and appear queer anyway? It doesn't matter. But it's like special. And also, I almost feel like I don't deserve it when people say, oh, you're a queer icon, because in my brain is like, you know, the queer icons are Freddie and Joan Jett and Cyndi Lauper and Elton John and those people. But it can also be me, because to be queer is to be unlimited, right? Yeah. And the conversation around gay rights and trans rights, all of that is constantly evolving. Yeah. So who's to say we don't need somebody now to be that advocate, right? That could be me now. And obviously my queerness looks very different than Elton John's queerness, but it doesn't matter. To be queer is to be unlimited and Absolutely. To be unabashedly yourself. So my goal is that, you know, young queer folks who need an example, like I needed when I was young, can look to us as, you know, positive role models. And, you know, not my entire band is not queer. Like, every male in my project is straight identifying. And so it's nice for them to see allies and queer folk in the same place, because a lot of times they don't have those positive relationships exemplified in their real lives. It's particularly important. And I feel particularly like emboldened to go out and be myself when we're in, like, you know, in New York, you get a lot of that. In high school, you can have those conversations. But when we're in Kansas, it's very, very different and very, very special for a queer 21-year-old to come to a show and know that they're going to be seen and taken care of and accepted and safe in that room. So there's a lot of responsibility to it. But on the other hand, it's just another part of who I am and another part of who all these people in the audience are. You don't have to other us. It's just who we are, you know, deal. You got to deal with it. We're not going anywhere.
I love that so much. Has that kind of being unabashedly you, has that always been something that's been easy for you? Has it come natural through the years, or how did that come?
No way. Oh my God, no way. Well, I think everybody, unless you, there are folks who always have felt that permission, and that's wonderful. And you know, when I finally did come around in my early 20s and closer to my mid 20s to coming out to my parents and coming out to my family, it was a huge relief. And I was met with so much respect and understanding. I'm very, very grateful for that. I know that that's not the case for everybody. And I went to a Catholic all girls high school, which is a very hard place to be a little bit gay. From all different avenues, you're getting this, you know, so I kept quiet and all that. Right. So there, it wasn't until my early 20s when I moved to New York and I saw that, you know, queer folks were not this like thing in a book that like go to hell for being themselves. Like, you're allowed to be yourself. The guy down the street, everybody is being themselves, right? Everybody dressing how they want, expressing how they want, dating who they want, right? So it wasn't until I got to New York that I really felt permission to fully be myself in my own brand of me and in my own brand of queerness, which also looks different on everybody. I think that was an aspect of it. And also I was just kind of like, you know, I was this musical kid who wanted to do theater and write songs in a family that they loved me and supported me and got me piano lessons, but they didn't really know what to do with me. And certainly my hometown didn't know what to do with me. It was very hard for me to make friends, especially in middle school. And then in high school, and even my first year of college, like I don't have any friends from the earlier half of my life. I don't have hometown friends. I don't have middle school or high school friends. I don't even have college friends. I don't keep up with any of those people because I was still in that place where I was being this half me, where I was trying to be me, but also toning down my artistry, toning down my self-expression to appease that. And once I decided to fully, you know, like be myself and grew into myself in my mid 20s, which is what everybody does, you know, I didn't maintain those friendships. So it was always a goal of mine when I would dream from the time I was like 18 about forming this band. I was like, And I'm look like that's, I think, also why I was so attracted to rock bands. I didn't have a lot of friends. So I'm looking at the E Street Band and like everybody's got their arms around each other and like, wow, they all get to go be in a, they get to get in a van and drive and go on vacation with each other and play shows. Like that's so much fun. Yeah. Pillow talk, bunk life, baby. So it was always a dream of mine to establish a big project where we felt like family and we could go out and exemplify that. I'm very grateful to, I mean, this is literally why we're called friends. And so I'm very grateful to have formed those relationships now. And we get a lot of messages from people who are, you know, I came to the show and I have a hard time making friends, but I hear your story and I know that you made these friends later in life and those relationships seem so true. That's really inspiring. Or I made friends at your concert and that was really big for me. So it wasn't always easy to make friends. And I didn't really form these lasting relationships until adulthood. But I'm very grateful for them. I try not to think about like time lost or the formative coming of ages experiences I never had because I'm living such a full life now. So yeah, it's hugely rewarding. It's hugely rewarding.
Incredible. And yeah, and it's cool to see what's come from you being you and giving space for other people to be themselves as well. And I'm excited I can't wait to see it. Like that's one of those where, I mean, it's been what now a year since I like was scrolling through Spotify, just trying to find something new and something fun. And it like brought me out of like a sad time. And I'm excited to like now see it live and see it with people who are part of this big community where it's everyone's friends. And so I'm going with one of my best friends too. And so yeah, I can't wait. I am still leaving. I hope I get to talk to you some other time because I have other questions and there were so many interesting things please. I found in my prep, but I finished the interview with 5 questions, the same 5 of every interview. So I wanted to give time for that. They're mostly quick questions.
Yeah. Sure.
Next time there was a Sour Patch pre-show ritual. I need to ask about that. Or I was going to, if this was in person, I would have Sour Patches for you. But, well, is it regular or watermelon? That was my question.
Regular. So to give it to you brief, when we first started touring and we found out what a rider was, which is food that shows up at every show, we would always have Sour Patch Kids because we all love Sour Patch Kids. But then we would get into deep trouble because every night for 7 nights in a row, a venue is giving you a Costco sized bag of Sour Patch Kids. So we and we were like sick. Oh my God. And right. So we're just like eating them by the handful and not realizing that you had to pace yourself. So we've since taken those out of the rider and replaced them with dried fruit. But as a little treat to each other, or when we do something really, like when we play a really big show, we'll get some Sour Patch Kids to keep humble, you know? So they're so not in the rider anymore. They're not in the rider anymore, but we'll probably have a Sour Patch party at Turbo 5. Yeah.
Okay. That's how you know this is a Sour Patch show. Okay. Thank you. I wanted to ask that. It was very fun. It was
Sour
like
Patch on the house, everybody. You played great tonight, boys.
It was one of those questions that I wrote. I'm like, I made this interview, the questions like a month ago. And I'm like, what was this? I can't remember, but it's here and it's fun.
Sour Patch question mark.
What was that?
I said Sour Patch question mark.
Yeah. Yeah. It was that Sour Patch regular or watermelon question mark.
Always regular.
The first question I ask at the end of every interview is, if you had to choose between breakfast food, lunch food, or dinner food, only food from each meal group. So only breakfast food, only lunch food, or only dinner food for every meal, which would you choose?
Oh man, only lunch food, because I mean, we love a good egg, we love a good breakfast burrito, and we love a good plate of pasta. But I mean, mostly for breakfast anyway, I do like a smoothie, which is just like a deconstructed salad in a blender anyway. Yeah,
that's funny.
So I think with lunch, you got a little protein, a little veggie in there. I think all the food groups are typically represented by lunch. And so I would do that. I would do lunch all the time.
Good choice.
Always lunch.
Number 2 is, what's your go-to karaoke song?
You're gonna laugh because I haven't done karaoke in a long time. I always sing "Hopelessly Devoted to You" from Greece.
That's amazing.
I haven't even thought about that in a long time. Oh yeah, oh yeah. Because like you go to the karaoke bar and like if I don't sing "Living on a Prayer," somebody else will.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
But you, somebody is going to sing "We Are the Champions," but you don't often hear "Hopelessly Devoted to You." So I do that one, or I do "If I Ain't Got You" by Alicia Keys.
Okay. Oh, great. That's on. I don't have the voice for that, but I have a go-to karaoke. Karaoke's "My Terminal 5." And that's a song that's on my dream karaoke list, but I don't think I couldn't do it. I don't have the voice for it. I can only do.
You just need the right key.
I don't know keys. So I just have fast songs. So I've become like a Destiny's Child cover band and.
Oh yeah.
I can do that. Yeah. I can do like "Independent Woman." I can do "Say My Name." "Bugaboo," all those are hits karaoke, but they really hide my voice. And
yes.
And so
got it. Cool.
Number three is a guilty pleasure you have while on tour.
Sour Patch Kids. let me think what else. Sleeping in big late. Like, if I'm waking up in the city of soundcheck and I don't have to be at soundcheck until 4 and I know that I'm going to go on stage and like, if we go on, typically we're playing at like 9:30 or 10 PM. And that's just such an adrenaline rush. It's like 90 minutes of cardio, first of all. And then there's all this adrenaline. So it's like, you can't go to sleep until 2 o'clock in the morning. You literally are not done working until midnight, but then you can't sleep until 2-3 o'clock in the morning. So my guilty pleasure is like, if I have to be at soundcheck and it's across the street at 4 PM, I'll sleep until 2. Yeah.
That's amazing. No, I would do
this. I'll be in bed from 3 PM until 2 PM. I have a potential 11 hours and I'll usually get like 9 of those. So yeah, sleeping in. Love sleeping in.
Number four is one band that's not currently together that you'd love to have one more EP from.
Oh, wow. What a question. Oh, the Doobie Brothers.
Oh, great. Amazing.
Yeah, the Doobie Brothers. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's the answer. That is the answer. 100%. Yeah, they're so cool. Or Wings. Paul McCartney's Wings.
Yeah.
And what I appreciate about both Wings and the Doobies is that they were so, there was like always this cohesive thing. And for the Doobie Brothers, it was like, you know, Michael McDonald for a while and then whoever else came in and did that thing. But there was always this cool feel good groove and like tight harmonies. Right. And with Wings, obviously the cohesive is always like Paul McCartney being literally like an immortal wizard of music, but they were constantly reinventing every time they released something. So it would be interesting to see what Wings or the Doobies were up to in 2022, what they would give us.
And number five is an interesting guest that you recommend I have on the Road Trip Playlist podcast.
Ooh, what a great question. Who are you looking for? Like, what are your big things?
It's just someone that I'll have a good conversation with. So, and that like, it's nice if I gravitate towards their music, but it's also nice to be like, find more music from it.
Huh. You should talk to Sub Radio.
Okay.
Which is this crazy, kooky quintet of boys from DC who are doing the like, pop boy group thing, but much more sophisticated and incredibly amazing. Talented musicians. They tour with us very frequently. They were friends of ours from like the Rockwood days. Wow. And we take them on the road whenever we can. They're from DC. They're in DC. We're in Brooklyn, and we've had very different climbs. They have had this enormous explosion of fan base, through Reddit that when people started live streaming on Reddit, or live streaming during the big lockdown months of COVID, they were on Reddit all the time. And so what's interesting about them is they have this fan base where sure they have a little more people anywhere than anywhere in DC, but they have like fans from like the Netherlands, South Africa, yeah. Brazil, Colombia, New York, Milwaukee, whatever. So they joke too, like when we have them on at the end of every set, they always go, "We're Sub Radio. We're from the internet. Thank you for having a great night." So they have this very interesting perspective where so much of their growth has been digital, but they find this really wonderful way to still make it really organic on stage. So yeah, you can talk to those guys.
That's really cool.
And they're great people.
I feel like anyone that's played Rockwood is like a band that I'll love. Rockwood's like where when I was moved here as a new music writer, I was there like every single day of the week for like 3 hours covering different shows. So it has such a special place in my heart.
That's so cool. Yeah. I mean, you could also talk to Will Leet, who's our guitarist. Will has his own solo project. He's in the middle of making a huge, really powerful feature length full length album right now. I think it's going to have like 12 tracks on it. And he's got a really interesting story. And he kind of came up from Rockwood as well. Amazing. And then we did the kids thing. But you would have a good conversation with him.
Oh, too. I would love that. That's so, both of those I would definitely reach out to. So thank you so much again.
Yes, please do.
Thank you so much for the time. It's been, it was well worth the wait. And like, I'm so glad that we were able to have it. I'm glad that I get to talk to you and get to see you live. So thank you so much.
Yeah, me too. Of course. Thank you so much for having me. This was an absolute joy. I can't wait to hear this back.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Have a wonderful day.
Cool.
Thanks again.
All right, you too. I'll see you with T5.
Exactly. Have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye.
You have now reached your destination. Thank you for listening to the Road Trip Playlists podcast. Don't forget to follow, rate, and review for more interviews with your favorite artists.
Thank you so much again for listening to my interview with Sammy Ray of Sammy Ray and the Friends. Make sure you go stream Sammy Ray and the Friends' music. See them whenever you can, follow along, and also follow the podcast for more interviews with your favorite artists.